Welcome to Flip Table Theology, a weekly conversation centered around flipping tables of oppression, injustice, privilege, division, and religion as acts of faith and worship.
We are so excited you guys are joining us at this table. Grab a cup of coffee or a cup of tea and let's dive in.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Flip Table Theology. I am joined once again with my good friends, Holly Madden and Sharita Thomas Tate. I am Christy Love. And this week we are talking about purity culture. March is Women's History Month. And so as the three of us were talking and brainstorming what some different issues that we could talk about and touch base on related to deconstruction and religious trauma and issues of justice in the world of faith and religion, the impact of purity culture is one that all three of us really kind of named as something that needs to be talked about more and more and needs to be talked about from a lens of deconstruction and religious trauma. I'm going to kind of just start with maybe what are your own thoughts, feelings just about this topic, because I recognize, and we should probably issue a trigger warning on this conversation, because I have no doubt that paths will take us down some roads that may bring up topics related to sexual assault or body image, rape, self-harm. I don't know where all we will end up, but I just know with life experiences and a lot of the data and statistics that those may be some topics that we end up touching base on. So Holly, I start with you. Just talk to me a little bit about how your heart, your mind, your spirit is feeling coming into this conversation on this topic.
Yeah, I think I was in middle high school in the early 2000s. And so I was in a private Christian school, and I've talked about that quite a bit on podcasts. And so I had a lot of language, a lot of rules, a lot of narratives that I experienced in that, especially in that season, in that preteen teenage years of around purity culture. And so, yeah, this is definitely a really heavy topic. There's definitely a lot of triggers in this, but I feel like it's so important because I think that as I, have come into my 30s now, and I turned 33 here at the end of this week. I have
Holly's
seen
the baby on our podcast.
I have found so much healing in that part of the religious roots of that. I've also found so much like empowerment in embracing, you know, my femininity and embracing a lot of those things that had been shamed a lot inside of the church, inside of my school setting, and along a lot of my peers. And so I feel like this dual piece of like, man, it's really hard to think back to a lot of those things and conversations I had. And I mean, getting sent to the principal's office because my straps were too thin or because my shorts were too short. And like those things that were just like made me so self-conscious and so self-aware of my own body. And in the context of like your the way you dress is making men stumble, you know, your brothers in Christ stumble was a lot of what I heard. And then that really led to, you know, on that modesty side of thing, that led to, you know, some really trigger warning. Like I vividly remember having a really horrific experience in my early 20s where I was assaulted in a parking lot. And I remember being in the emergency room after that and hearing somebody ask me what I was wearing. Mm-hmm. And it was after work and I was wearing a work uniform. And like, I was like justifying why that, you know, that didn't play into that instead of feeling a sense of like, why the hell would you ask that? Like, that doesn't matter. What happened was not okay. Was not my fault. Should never have happened. There was nothing about anything that I did or said that should ever be called into question. It should all be centered around this other individual. And so even the roots of that I've had to deconstruct, I've had to heal from, I've had to sit with and grieve, I carry into this conversation. And so I think for me personally, there's a lot of like caution and sensitivity because I know how many people have such deep roots with that and so many deep traumas. And also being really proud to be in a season and in a space, I think, culturally, where there is a lot of conversation out of that. And I think there is more of a movement of like, let's name that. And so I'm, you know, being on the empowering side of it, I think feels really good. So,
and I would love to believe that that is not common theology anymore, right? Mm-hmm. Like that idea of questioning what the woman was wearing. Like we'd all love to believe that, like, oh wow, well, we're making these huge shifts and mm-hmm. in our religious culture, that that's not the case anymore. But I was reading headlines recently into February. There was a story out of North Carolina, a Bible Baptist Tabernacle pastor in North Carolina comes under fire and his sermon video goes viral because he said, and I quote, women, let's see. Well, the quote is, if you dress like that, he was relating to women wearing shorts and how that was not okay. And he was talking about modesty. And he said, if you dress like that, meaning wearing shorts, and you get raped and I'm on the jury, he's going to go free. I'm right, you know, because a man's a man. And so, you know, he's now apologized for these comments, but he's still pastoring that church. There's not been any accountability for that. And so like that ongoing narrative that mm-hmm. you named, Holly, that you dealt with personally, I had a similar sexual assault in college. And the question for me wasn't what I was wearing, but it was, what was I doing and why was I there? Mm-hmm. And so I was at a party, I had been drinking. And so immediately the Christian men in my life at that time started mm-hmm. to kind of imply that I was at fault for being in the wrong place and for engaging in bad behavior. And somehow then that justified the assault that happened to me. Mm-hmm. Just like it, purity culture, I think, always seeks to justify bad behavior. Mm-hmm. with being in the wrong place, wearing the wrong thing, doing the wrong thing, having the wrong friends, instead of talking about what the actual problem is, which is the violence against women that suffered in those spaces.
Against women and against, I think the number one population, the majority population you see is attacks against women in that. But I also want to name, there's a lot of horrific narratives and language and attacks that happen to non-binary individuals, to people that identify as queer. So I want to name that too, because I think there's a whole different complex conversation that happens in the purity culture world, that, and it doesn't just impact women. So
yeah, absolutely. Sherita, how about you? What do you bring on your heart into this conversation?
You know, I see the world through the lens of my culture. And so I interpret purity culture from that space. And growing up in the Black church, there was not, I don't believe, the same emphasis on purity culture that I think that was present in white evangelical spaces. However, that kind of framework definitely was adopted by the Black church, because I do believe it is a more of a kind of a framework that is rooted in white supremacy and capitalism and patriarchy. But I do think that the Black church adopted some of that framework, but didn't push it to the same degree. But the part that I think was pushed was not having agency over your body, mm-hmm. Particular as women. Mm-hmm. I think our society has placed very little value on the bodies of Black women, in a sense of wanting to protect Black women's bodies and to value our bodies outside of sex. Black women have been used as the portrait of sexuality in a negative sense, as the loose woman. Within the Black church, the Jezebel kind of a thought kind of perpetuated women within the church. And also, given that women were the majority of many Black churches, women were seen as the temptress, the one who were tempting men. And, you know, we had to be responsible also for men and their behavior. But also, when things did happen, there was no protection, there was no support, there was no even, you know, a whole lot of concern or empathy, because our bodies weren't worth the support or the compassion. And I think that has impacted a lot of women, both inside and outside of their relationships, including myself.
Well, and I think that we look historically, Sherita, we see out of the Black church movement, you know, was really born the womanist movement, which was led by Black women theologians and Black liberation theologists who, you know, Alice Walker and others, who often as that foundational piece named what you're talking about, that, you know, Black women did not have agency over their own body and that their bodies were objectified. And oftentimes rape culture was unfortunately an enormous component of
chattel slavery.
Slavery in our country. And so you're exactly right. I think that that is a critical component for us to name. And there are still to this day, I think, huge differences that a lot of people don't want to talk about in culture and in society and in the church when it comes to the nuances of how purity culture is addressed from racial and ethnic standpoints.
And for me,
still enormous.
This topic carries over to all other systems in our society, like the educational system and the mental health systems and the medical systems and the justice systems, where Black women are held accountable for things that white women may not be held accountable for and punished in ways that are different and also are not resourced in ways. The fact that we still have in our medical field, in our medical society, the fact that me as an educated Black woman has a higher risk of mortality due to pregnancy than a low-income, uneducated white woman by almost double is crazy. That's the case, that my both education and wealth don't protect me in our medical system from medical malpractice.
Well, and because we just had headlines a week ago that there was, you know, a woman who passed away on the East Coast. I want to say it was in Baltimore or Pittsburgh, but had just given birth to a healthy baby and passed away within hours of that as a Black woman in that hospital. And so, again, time and time again.
Because doctors, as far as what I read and been told, is that medical schools still teach that Black women don't feel pain in the same way. Mm-hmm. That we don't experience pain in the same way. Our bodies are different, so we don't experience pain. So a lot of times when we express what we're feeling in our bodies, it's not taken seriously.
Yeah. I think that another component of the racial division in purity culture is also something that we're seeing right now that has really kind of been taking off the last couple of years on TikTok. And it's what's called the trad wife trend, which is shortened for traditional wife, the housewife trend. So you've got, you know, this huge like social influencer culture that is built around white evangelical Christianity. And you have, you know, these women and couples who are really kind of trying to glorify this standard, right? Mm-hmm. This is the way God intended for things to be, and that the woman would stay home and keep house and make dinner. And so you have this kind of trad wife movement that is a lot of like traditional cooking and cleaning and tips on that, and like how to be a sexy housewife and how to be like a cool, trendy mom who dedicates yourself to your kids in that component. And again, I think we see predominantly that trend is being carried out in our culture by white women and white married women who kind of uphold this traditional view of family and marriage. And so where I think we also are seeing a lot more talk and traction around the trad wife trend is coming into the election. You know, there are many political pundits who are naming that it's these white trad wives, these white housewives that could really make the difference in this election, and that they have these morals and values, which is why we saw in the State of the Union address last week, the Republican response to that was from a white, middle-aged housewife sitting in her kitchen.
Senator.
Senator, right.
Downplays her senator and upplays her traditional wife.
And a wife, mm-hmm. and the traditional morality pieces of all of that. So, I mean, I think we definitely see this like almost caricature really mm-hmm. kind of coming back into our culture in a way that is definitely going to be interesting to watch.
Which for me is also anti-Black. It's anti-Black. Exactly. It's anti-Black in that Black women are less likely to be and get married. We're Black women are the most educated demographic in the U.S., so we're more likely to be out in the workforce, which lets us not be that traditional wife. We're not going to be that. And because of that, it's anti-Black. It's anti-me because I'm not ever going to be that person that is being glorified as the standard. I'm not going to ever be that.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's anti a lot of things, right? It's anti-Black woman. It is anti-queer. It is, you know, anti- any family that doesn't look like a traditional family model, right? So women who've decided to pursue parenthood as a single person, you know, single parents, all of those components don't line in to that image that purity culture upholds mm-hmm. that is such a small population, mm-hmm. you know, small segment of our population in general, that I think we're consistently trying to like polarize and push people to the margins and continue to uphold this value mm-hmm. that when we look like sociologically, that's just not the majority in our culture anymore is the, you know, white evangelical mm-hmm. nuclear family that is not the majority any longer.
And it never was for many Black families. But I think what I'm hearing us saying though here is a recognition that purity culture has a huge hold on American culture in the greater realm, you know, mm-hmm. with regards to our politics and all of the other types of spaces that this purity culture has permeated and lives in. And I think, again, it goes back to white supremacy, capitalism, and patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. I think something that I really struggle with too, that I think purity culture speaks a lot over women, is that submissive type of a space. And I think that you see a lot of that contradiction of like that traditional housewife model too, of like where there is submission and where there is power. And like, I know that I think that there is something so disconnected in the way that the very natural feminine is nurturing, is mothering, whether you are physically a mother or not. Like, there is so much really beauty and compassion in every single aspect of purity culture. Those pieces are dismissed, and it's much more overseen as like the submission side of it, this like role side of it, is are you doing these things that fit this model? Are you acting a certain way, look a certain way, talking a certain way? And it's these very critical, harsh standards, when the reality is like, regardless of whether a woman chooses to, and I say this as somebody who like, I have been so lucky that over the last 6 years, I've been able to be home with my babies. And the reality was, I remember feeling some weird shame in that as a very progressive woman, like I wanted to be able to caretake my children at home. Like, and I was blessed to be able to also get to do things I was really passionate about and work in while I got to be home with my kids. And like, there was a lot of that weird shame that I had to process through, and there's nothing wrong with the fact that I want to be in this space. I don't want to align with what feels traditional. Like, I don't want to be that person because I've been so harmed by that, because I see so much harm in that. And at the same time, recognizing my privilege in that, recognizing that this was something that was really beautiful for me. And so, you know, I think of just that piece of it as like, there is something about the way the feminine mind and body is wired that is just that mothering energy is beautiful. And that is so removed from it, because it takes out that power. It takes out that like beautiful aspect of, the way that we lead, the way that we love, the way that we communicate, the way we interact with the world and some of those different pieces. And I just I see how shame has replaced a lot of that.
Well, yes. And I would also say that I think part of what we see in that culture, Holly, kind of like in naming what you're saying, is I think that femininity has always been seen as a weapon in purity culture, right? Mm-hmm. It is dangerous. So you hear terms like the Jezebel spirit. You hear terms like, you know, the women without morals, or like being the temptress, right? Like these kind of spaces that have always in purity culture framed those aspects of who women are and what femininity is as dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so because of those things, you saw like absolutes put in place in evangelical culture, like the Billy Graham rule, right? Mm-hmm. Billy Graham says in his ministry, I don't ever want there to be a suspicion of impropriety or of any kind of like sexual deviance. So I'm going to make this arbitrary rule for myself and those who work with me that I will never be alone with a woman. So, you know, Billy Graham's waiting for an elevator. A woman comes up to get on the elevator. He's going to let her get on and he's going to wait for the next elevator because he doesn't want to be alone on an elevator with a woman. And so like you have this culture that then started to see women as dangerous and as bad and, you know, as seductive and all of these kind of pieces. And I think what is also challenging about that, and you said it just a second ago, Holly, but like, is that each person is so uniquely wired for gifts and strengths and all of those pieces. There is a wiring in a lot of women, not all of them, that is maybe more relational or more affectionate or looks at things from a different perspective because we have been concerned about, you know, how women could be tempting, how women could harm men. The obvious answer, therefore, is to just sideline them completely and to deprive the church of the gifts that women can bring into that space and to loop all of that in under patriarchal theology, right? Which is a whole nother conversation that we can have. But I do think that I hear you in the feeling the need to even like apologize for being a progressive person who values these things. Because it's not one or the other. And I think that that's really important to recognize is that purity culture tries to paint things as black and white, right? Or as like in or out, good or bad. It's a binary that purity culture is really built upon. And I think what we know is that in reality, nothing's a binary. There's always nuanced gray area and there's always ambiguity and all of that. And I think we see that a lot, as you named earlier, in our non-binary siblings and our queer siblings and like, the struggle with gender roles and how that plays out is incredibly complex, but I do think there's this root of purity culture and the hard, fast binaries that plays into so much of that.
And I think that purity culture also is creating a standard that is not realistic at all and sets a lot of people up for failure because even if I follow all these rules as much as I can, it doesn't guarantee your happiness, your safety, your well-being, that you'll even, you know, none of those things are guaranteed by following these sets of rules. And my worth is tied to my purity. If I am pure and I don't get those things that are associated with purity, then I must not be pure enough. Or if I don't follow the rules and I'm impure, then I'm unworthy of good things to come to me. And it just creates this identity of self-hate and failure and shame.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, you talk about the evangelical church and like for women, the ultimate standard that was held up from a very young age was the ridiculous narrative around Proverbs 31, right? And this fictional idea of what this person should be and what this role as the good wife should look like. And man, I had such a love-hate relationship with that image growing up because for me, like there was so much of myself, even young, like middle school, high school, that didn't identify with any of that and was like, that doesn't sound like anything that I want to work to be, right? Which, like you just said, Sharita, then made me feel like, well, there's something wrong with me, right? Mm-hmm. I was a square peg in a round hole as a woman growing up in this situation, in this evangelical setting. But then like, as you get older and you start to realize, first of all, this isn't even realistic to do all of these things. And then second of all, as a biblical scholar, and you start to look at the book of Proverbs and you start to realize this was not a biographical account, right? This was a very false projection of what women should be as a whole versus what one person should be able to do and accomplish in themselves. And I think
idealism.
Yes. And that shame narrative was so incredibly strong, which is why as we do trauma research in the area of religious trauma with women specifically, but I agree 100%, Holly, it's not just women that are impacted by these mindsets. We see higher rates of self-harm. We see higher rates of eating disorders. We see higher rates of body image issues, anxiety, depression, all of these kind of issues. Mm-hmm. A lot of times are because we've been taught there's an unrealistic standard from the very beginning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I, as a teen, dealt with body image issues to a lesser degree, but to a greater degree, control issues with which led to eating disorder. And mm-hmm. my eating disorder was rooted in a lack of control. What can I control? I can control what's in my going in my body, since I couldn't control what was done to my body.
Mm-hmm. I had a youth leader growing up. I remember this vividly. We were at a retreat and I had a youth leader who I would consider to be a trad wife now looking back, who I vividly remember making a comment in a group of, I think I was seventh or eighth grade. I was before high school and there were probably 10 of us as girls in that room. And she made a comment about making sure that we prioritize exercise and eating right, because men wouldn't want us if we were chunky and curvy. And so like that was on us as an act of worship. Like mm-hmm. I can remember us having this conversation about making sure that we were staying in shape as an act of worship and obedience so that we could be desirable when that time came. And like, I just remember thinking to myself, you've got to be freaking kidding me. Mm-hmm. How toxic, and I still think about how toxic that was and how that shaped myself, my own image of myself and the other girls that were in that room. That really, like, if I start to trace that back, that introduced to me a lot of things that I didn't struggle with mm-hmm. before some of those conversations and those narratives were introduced into my world. I didn't struggle with eating disorders until I got into my freshman and sophomore years of high school. Mm-hmm. And I do attribute some of those issues that I developed to those mindsets that were introduced to me mm-hmm. in faith spaces. And they were introduced to me around value and mm-hmm. worth and my responsibility as an act of holiness.
Mm-hmm. I think that there is also like this piece of purity culture that so almost so hypersexualizes the body that it teaches this like I think of my kids and I think of the way that they love to run and play and dance, and like we try really hard to speak language into them about like being proud of the strength in their body, that, you know, their Eliana right now is really into the monkey bars and just like the strength in her muscles and her ability to get to do that on. And our bodies they're designed in such a intricate and incredible way. You know, our minds, our brains, like there's just so much good and there's so much creativity and there's so much science embedded in us. The purity culture that hypersexualizes feminine body is dangerous, that there is, you know, pieces of you that are not safe, and that, you know, and then as a woman, like fearing men, fearing that control, that power piece of it is really, really overwhelming. And I think how often, I don't know, like we're taught then inside of purity culture not to trust our bodies mm-hmm. and we're taught not to trust those different like innate pieces of what we're seeing that as dark, as sinful, as something to cover up, as something to hide. And that's both physically and also like our personalities, to cover those things that we're like, well, I don't fit into this. And so I have to hide that. I have to try to change myself. And how much that leads to so many problems of like, we don't trust our gut. You walk into a situation and we're taught to be like, well, I can't trust my body because you know, if I can't trust my body in this situation, I can't trust when I have that like intuitive, like, oh, this is not safe or this is not for me, or you know, those different pieces of it. Like, we don't trust the way that our bodies are wired to shift and to change and to grow. You know, having had the privilege of giving birth to children, like, my body changed after that. Postpartum bodies, not feeling shame, feeling disgust over pieces of that season, like, and how much of that is just embedded in this. I don't innately feel pride in my body. I feel shame, and how much of that is rooted inside of purity culture, and how much deconstruction has been required to be able to get to a point of like being able to see. Like, I remember one time one of my kiddos was sick, and Ellie, she mentioned like, I'm proud of my stomach because I've been like, it's doing its job. I don't feel good, but it's doing its job. And just being like, I don't feel that way. I want to feel proud of my body though. I want to feel proud of myself. I want to feel proud of the pieces of me that don't fit into this narrative and this context. Mm-hmm. And that's different from you and different from other females, but this part of me that is very feminine or whatever those pieces are. And I think that's part of that piece that I feel so passionate about. And I think I've been a little bit more quiet and like struggle to talk because like I have felt really triggered in this conversation. And so wanting to name that even listening to this may feel really triggering. Also, there is so much beauty and there is so much power on being able to finally identify that and finding the roots to say like, I can see that the roots are in this, that like, I don't have to feel shame anymore because they're rooted in, mm-hmm. you know, what somebody else said to me and you had shared what someone had said to you. Like, I vividly remember being in high school and I remember having a male peer of mine call me at home to tell me that he was concerned about the way that my tops had, you know, like they were showing a little bit too much cleavage or something like that. And I vividly remember like getting off the phone with him and just sobbing, like curling up on the floor of my bedroom and feeling so much shame over myself. I didn't tell anybody about it. I didn't tell my parents. I didn't tell, you know, anybody at school. I didn't tell my friends, but I changed the way that I dressed for a long time because of that. And just a single conversation and something that had been taught and embedded in him and how much I still think about that. Mm-hmm. And I still feel the shame of that. I still feel the embarrassment of just the way my body was designed. And yeah.
So I want to kind of touch on that, Holly, but I also want to take us in a little bit of a tangent because we talked a little while ago about like some of the political power around this. And I want to circle back around to that because I think it's really important that we also name the hypocrisy that is on full display in the last 8-10 years in our country of like people who grew up as proponents of purity culture, people who grew up preaching purity culture, parenting purity culture, who are also voting for an individual in 2016 and is now running again, was on Access Hollywood talking about groping and grabbing women with no shame, who has been
accused by many women of,
right, who's been accused by multiple women, who is now facing legal judgments with actions sexually against women. There's a double standard and a duplicity that is like rampant across our culture, but we're seeing it played out in the highest political places of what does this look like when 81% of evangelicals voted the first time around to put Trump in office, who constantly justified and dismissed all of these charges and claims and comments that he's made with women. Yet he's the candidate, mm-hmm. for the Republican Party, which is traditionally shaped by these traditional value spaces. Like, again, just the duplicity and the hypocrisy of that.
Well, yeah,
so I mean, unbelievable to me.
Sexual violence is rooted in power, mm-hmm. and in this country and in most countries, men have more power than women, both physical and political power. Here in Missouri, where we're recording, our state legislator mandated that women in the state legislature not wear bare arms in the House because it was impure or sexual in some way for them to have bare arms. And yet, women are the minority in that space. Women hold less power in that space. Yet now we are held to a standard based on what men find to be dangerous. And it's just crazy to me because in American culture, on television, breast is dangerous, but a gun is not. A woman's body is not allowed, but death and violence is allowed. It shows you how much this idea of purity culture is embedded into our greater society here in the United States and how insidious it is.
Well, and like, I think about the example you gave, Holly, from your childhood, like that guy that calls you, right? First of all, like, I would be intrigued to know what his life looks like today, just because to have that kind of power as a middle school student, to feel like you're empowered enough to call someone and say those things to them, right? Like when that kind of toxic masculinity isn't checked, isn't corrected, I think we see it turn into things. The president's comments, you know, when Trump was running for office the first time around on Access, like we feel emboldened that we don't have to be accountable to those spaces. The countless number of headlines that we've seen over the last 15 years of pastors who've been accused of wrongdoing and of sexually assaulting women in their congregation or grooming young girls and then marry them when they're 17 or 18 years old. And all of these pieces of that, we haven't even really touched on the toxic pieces of that theology and how that can play out when intersected with unchecked and unaccountable masculinity.
One of the things that I remember growing up very vividly was teen pregnancy and how that was dealt with. When a young woman was pregnant as a teenager, she was, we can't have a baby shower for her. We're not going to celebrate her. We're going to take care of her, but we're not going to celebrate her in any kind of way because this is wrong. But that same boy goes out and gets another girl pregnant and another girl pregnant and another girl pregnant. He can be a musician. He can preach. He can teach. He can continue to do whatever he wants to do. But that woman is sat down because we won't glorify her pregnancy as a teen. But the man has no accountability. There's nothing he is held accountable to. And that sticks out to me in my brain from growing up under that kind of purity culture.
Well, and I think of, and this was my experience in that assault I talked about earlier on the podcast, how many times men who do horrific, violent things like that get away with it because women justify, oh, it's because it was my fault. I did something wrong. I was dressed a certain way. I was drinking. I was in a space I should not have been. I mean, I remember thinking like, I should not have walked to my car by myself. I should not have walked down that road by myself. I'm going to take accountability and responsibility, and how much ingrained in women is, I need to be accountable for this. And that's going to let you off of what you did or what you said. And yeah, that, like you said, Sharita, I think it's just not even realizing how much that's ingrained in culture and in media and in tradition and all of those pieces.
Well, and I think with that, Holly, is also the amount of self-hatred for women that becomes normalized in that space. Mm-hmm. You know, like for me, I 100% bought into that. Mm-hmm. When I was raped in college, I 100% bought into the theology that it was my fault, that I was doing bad things. I was being sinful in what I was doing, who I was with, what I was engaged in. And I internalized the feeling that I deserved that. And I internalized that feeling for a long, long time. And it was not until I started the processes of early deconstruction, and I wouldn't have even called it deconstruction at the beginning, right? It started really for me around gender roles in the church. It started with patriarchy. It started with a lot of those spaces. And the more that I started to dig and question and wonder, the more I started to connect the dots, and the more that I recognized how much damage I had done to myself because I was complicit in accepting that theology instead of pushing back on it, because I didn't know to push back on it at the beginning, right? Like, it was an echo chamber in my world. Everyone I talked to thought that way and felt that way and affirmed that. And it wasn't until I kind of was able to step back and remove myself and get some different perspective and recognize, like, holy cow, how incredibly traumatizing it is to teach these things to begin with, but then how incredibly traumatizing to dismiss people's trauma with theology and to attach God's approval of trauma and hurt and violence that had been suffered to us as a means of righteous punishment. The levels of that, I think, are just, and they're incredibly hard to unpack, and they're incredibly hard to, those knots get really tied up in ourselves. And so I think, just as a word to women who are deconstructing, that there's a lot of complexities that you may not have connected to religious trauma yet. And as you start to think about those things and you start to realize the connections and you start to connect the dots, it's kind of like, holy cow. Like, I didn't realize. And I would say to men, you're not off the hook in that, because as you start to deconstruct, A, you've got to recognize what you were complicit in and what you also helped to perpetuate in that system. And like, what does that look like as part of deconstruction? To help rebuild that which was broken by those mindsets.
And I want to jump on just something you said too, because I think that on top of that, like, I believe this theology, because I did too. I feel like there's also just a piece of being able to say, like, it's also horrible to be in a place where you've been harmed in a way that is so vulnerable, and it is so, feels so shameful, and it's so, I mean, it's physically, it's mentally, it's emotionally damaging. And to feel like, if I choose to, if I want to try to believe that there is an ounce of wrongness in this, if I want to try to question that, then I have to put myself in a place of, like, putting my vulnerability out there, putting my shame out there, putting this thing that happened to me that I may feel ashamed, even though it's not sexual assault, violence, assault, any of that, rape is not shameful, but to feel that and to be the person that has been harmed in that way is absolutely terrifying. And I remember, like, being asked if I wanted to press charges, and I was a woman that said no, because I did not want to hear that people tell me that they didn't believe me. Or I had heard in the past, oh, don't do that to him, that'll ruin his life, feeling that accountability. And so I think I also want to name that if you have had an experience like that, that the guilt of not saying something, not doing something, is not yours to hold, and it's not yours to keep carrying, because there is so much ingrained in that. And to be in a place of, like, I need to heal physically, I need to heal emotionally, it is so complex to say, like, I'm going to say something and pursue, and that may mean that I'm completely alone, because everybody around me is going to tell me it was my fault, is going to tell me not to ruin this person's life, is going to tell me that they don't believe me. And that is hard. That is so hard. And so I just want to encourage that, like, the guilt of whether or not you said or did something is not yours to keep holding either.
Yeah, I agree, Holly. Yes, absolutely. 100%. I also just want to name how purity culture robs us of the pleasure of our bodies and ourselves as sexual beings. I go again, rooted in the shame, and you can go all the way back to Adam and Eve story, creating shame over our bodies because of our coming into the knowledge of good and evil. And I think purity culture perpetuates and creates over-sexualized environment where we are constantly thinking about sex, and we're constantly thinking about our bodies, because they're so powerful and so dangerous that we can't talk about sex. We can't look at bodies. We can't talk about bodies. We're just not going to talk about it at all, because if you talk about it, you perpetuate it, and we're not going to do that at all. But we also, we build a cloud of a mystified cloud around the idea of sex in our bodies. And it's so unhealthy, because, you know, our bodies have multiple functions, and even as women, our breasts aren't just a sexual organ. It's it provides, you know, it has a purpose. They have a purpose. And yet we have to hide when we breastfeed children because it's seen as sexual somehow. It's just maddening to me that there are so many women who cannot appreciate their own bodies, can't appreciate sex, can't enjoy sex because of purity culture and the power that it has been put over them, and even how they engage with their partners with regards to power dynamics and force and submission and all those things that take away the pleasure that women could receive and have in sexual spaces.
If you want an interesting take on that whole topic, the Naked Pastor, David Hayward, has been doing a series of cartoons on Sundays that he releases on social media. And they are like purity culture cartoons. Mm-hmm. And they oftentimes are like sexy Sunday cartoons. I can't remember what the hashtag is that he uses, but that's kind of like the gist of it. And so it's usually couples that are in their bedroom, but they're like, they're unpackaging the damage of purity culture as it plays out in their bedroom. And so some of them have been incredibly pointed. I've kind of been paying attention. I pay attention to him anyway, but some of them have been funny and relatable, and some of them are just really sad to kind of read that different perspective from an artistic standpoint on that exact point, Sharita. Mm-hmm. So you might check that out if that's something that's of interest to you.
I encourage all of us, women and men, explore our connection with purity culture and how it has permeated the way that we think and act and engage with others. I think it is so built into the fabric of American culture that we don't recognize the impact of it on how we think and how we feel about ourselves and about each other. I think that some of the tensions that we see in our society with regards to men and women, and women and women, and men and men, and hetero and homo sexual relations could be diminished to a certain degree if we were to explore our history and our current practices that are rooted in purity culture.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. I think purity culture is often an unexplored contributor to a wide variety of social divisions and injustices and harms. And I think, again, until we pull that lens back and we're willing to have really honest conversations, I mean, for goodness sakes, many of the people who were huge proponents of the purity culture movement in the 90s and the early 2000s for you too, Holly, but like a lot, I mean, the purity culture was like a huge push in the late 80s, early 90s. And you have people who led that movement, like Joshua Harris, who's come out and said, this was toxic. This was harmful. This was harmful to me, to my relationships. And I can't imagine. And they've issued like blanket apologies for the harm that they did on the youth that they were working with at that time. And so like there is an understanding of that damage now that we're a little bit further out from that, but we're seeing a resurgence of these kind of values and these kind of narratives. And I think that's what's really critical and important is this isn't a historical conversation that we're examining the implications of. This is an ongoing issue in many, especially like we've said, white evangelical church spaces, extremely conservative and fundamental church spaces. This is a huge narrative that still exists, is still causing harm today, and is still being weaponized in so many different aspects of our culture. So you're exactly right, Sharita. I think we all owe it to ourselves, to our culture, to our relationships, to the generations that come behind us, to really have hard, complicated, uncomfortable conversations about this topic, and to really try to unearth how deep the damage goes in our lives individually, in our communities, in our churches, in our political systems.
Yeah. And there's the whole Be Sweet movement too that is embedded in that, you know, those Be Sweet, this whole genre of religious practices about women staying sweet, even speaking with the little baby voices and all that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Rooted in purity culture.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think of how healing it is to be in a space of getting to intentionally speak into the next generation or other women around me personally, and using language and narratives and addressing that. And so, and I think that's where it starts. Mm-hmm. Like, it starts with the people in your world. It starts, especially with children and teenagers in your world. And I think for me, just innately being able to say, even if I have this gut reaction to say something about like mm-hmm. someone's outfit or think about even myself, I do this so much with myself, wanting to like critique the way that I look and looking down and seeing my kiddos looking at me, and I can change this narrative. Like, I get to do this now in this moment. And so just like encouraging to, like, it starts with just such small rewirings of our brain, but the way that trauma works, the way that our body heals is incredible. And so like, the more that we practice that, the more that we catch that, the more that we replace that, like it literally causes our bodies to rewire. And so mm-hmm. there is healing possible, and it starts with just those little pieces. So I think I just want to end with that, like that little piece of encouragement that like you are changing things when you choose to intentionally change the conversation.
Yeah. I'm definitely feeling a little activated and triggered. Mm-hmm. So we just encourage you, if you're feeling that way after listening to this episode, take some time, do some grounding, do some deep breathing, whatever mm-hmm. it kind of takes for you. But also don't just dismiss those feelings of being activated, because usually mm-hmm. when we feel activated and triggered, it's usually a sign that there's some pieces of ourselves and our stories that are kind of trying to poke out like Jenga pieces to say mm-hmm. like, hey, this one's been buried a while. Let's pull this out and deal with it and talk mm-hmm. about it and examine it. And so I know that that work is hard, but I just challenge you, pay attention to the way that your body's reacting, the way that your mind, your heart, the memories that are triggered out of this conversation, because those may be some things your mind has protected mm-hmm. you from that need to be pulled out and need to be deconstructed and need to be talked about, and some religious trauma, some emotional, some physical trauma that needs some attention. Mm-hmm. So be mindful of those spaces as well. All right. We'll be back next week with another conversation. I think we're inviting some friends onto our next episode to talk about kind of the same kind of issues, but maybe from some different perspectives around women in the church as we continue to honor Women's History Month. All right. We'll see you guys back next week.